This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Adie. Today, we'll try to get an idea of the cost of the trade brouhaha with China and hear about the high-tech industry that's an Australian export success. Let's start with the recession. As you'll be aware, it's the worst since the Great Depression. The economy got 7% smaller in the June quarter, and despite the government's earlier optimism, we won't be having a V-shaped recovery and go back to where we were. Australia Together doesn't think we should aim for that. Lisa Folkes is with Social Ventures Australia, which is part of Australia Together.
So Australia Together is a coalition of organisations that looked at the situation that we're in. You know, it looked at all this sort of discussion about snapping back and, you know, coming back to where we were. And I guess sort of thought that in the areas that we work, you know, we're all social sector organisations, that actually where we started from wasn't that great in many ways. So there's an opportunity to try to build back better. And our focus is really around three pillars of what that looks like. It's around having a good start for every child across Australia, particularly giving them access to high quality early learning. It's about making a difference to the availability of affordable housing, social housing. And it's also about making sure that there are jobs for people to go to.
All right. Well, let's focus today on the jobs part. Hope at some point in the future to come in and talk about early learning and housing. But with jobs, I think we know a fair bit already about who's most affected in this downturn. What are you suggesting the government could do about employment?
So the responses to date have been very much about trying to save us from the worst effects of the restrictions, but also some of the immediate economic effects of the pandemic. So in a sense, you know, they have been about hibernating the economy. And obviously some people have missed out, so a lot of casuals have missed out. And we've seen job losses in particular parts of the economy, particularly young people, particularly women, and particularly those in the lowest income quartiles. What we would say is, okay, so we've done all this stuff about keeping people in jobs, that's great. But going forward, we really need to start to look to creating jobs. And the only part of the economy that really has the capacity, the appetite, we hope, to do something about that is the public sector. Because in the private sector, we see in every recession that they are very slow to re-employ.
What are you suggesting the government should be doing in terms of expanding the public sector for young people to get them employed?
Look, there are lots of things that can be done for young people. One is that the Commonwealth government could actually look to employing more young people itself. So in the Commonwealth public sector, it's about 145,000 employees, so it's a very large employer. And I think there are around 2,000 trainees, including graduate trainees. So simply by expanding that number, by quadrupling it, for example, the Commonwealth public sector could give opportunities to young people to build their skills, and particularly, you know, just think about some of the pressing challenges for the Commonwealth. Digital transformation, for example, the Commonwealth could step up and actually invest in creating new pathways for people to gain and apply IT skills, which are going to be important across the services sector. So that's one area where the Commonwealth as an employer can step up to engage people directly, mm-hmm. but also to make a practical contribution to development of new skills pathways for people in IT. Look, and there are other examples. So for many years, the Commonwealth has funded a range of environmental youth programs. I've been involved in them, and they're some of the most positive programs that I've ever seen to engage young people. They give young people an opportunity to do something that is seen publicly as worthwhile. They can operate right across the country, particularly in remote and regional communities. Great way of engaging Indigenous kids, kids from a range of pathways, but they're also an opportunity to learn how to work. Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, one of the risks at the moment is that there's a lot of talk about pouring money into skills. That's great, but skills don't actually get people jobs. In fact, what we see is a lot of people have skills that they can't use, and this is particularly true for young people, and there is no substitute for the authentic experience of going to work, learning to work with other people, learning to work towards a concrete outcome and applying those skills. And actually, that's what employers want too. They don't Indeed. Want people with certificate one or two in employability skills. They actually want someone who's had some experience working.
All right, some federal money directly in traineeships, perhaps apprenticeships, environmental youth jobs as well. Now, you touched briefly on women and I guess some regions. Are there, I suppose, approaches to getting more women into jobs?
Yeah, look, absolutely. So one of the go-to responses to recessions, to economic downturn, is to look at infrastructure. And that's great and it's important. And, of course, it's got a certain appeal because it's not necessarily recurrent expenditure, although, you know, given cost blowouts, some might argue differently. But we need to think more about social infrastructure. So we can see in the aged care system that the social infrastructure, the people that deliver those services, the workforce needs more help. You know, one of the features of Australia Together is we're pretty keen to see a lot of the priorities and the decision making made at the local level because, you know, communities are vastly different. So the priorities in particular communities will vary from place to place. But yes, there is an enormous opportunity to rebuild a better architecture to support the things we need for our everyday life.
Yeah, this is a bottom-up approach. Money comes from the government, but it's going to be bottom-up.
Absolutely. And that is one of the ways that you make sure that the money doesn't go in the wrong places. So you reduce the possibility of employers using this to put on people they would anyway, and you maximise the degree to which money goes to places that people really value, that makes the most impact. And, of course, the likelihood that those jobs will connect once the private sector does start to recover, that they will be relevant to the skills that are needed there.
Just briefly, Lisa, any signs the government's interested in this approach? I did note that Michaela Cash, the Federal Employment Minister, has announced funding for local jobs facilitators who'll be on the ground in specific regions. That sounds like a good step.
Absolutely. So those local partnerships with employers and civil society actors, that's a really great step. I guess the critical thing is, though, that they will not be able to create jobs. So to the extent that they're operating in communities where the labour market has really fallen away, where people lack confidence, then they won't actually be able to fix that. What they will be able to do, though, if they're given some resource, if their resources invested from elsewhere, they will be able to make sure that they're directed appropriately. So we need those to be empowered bodies. We need them to have a real, you know, a function more than talking. But we also need to make sure that we address demand for labour. And for the short term, for the short to medium term, that is going to be driven by the public sector.
Lisa, it's been really interesting. Good luck with it.
Thank you, Richard.
Lisa Folkes, speaking for Australia Together. This is The Money on Radio National and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Aidy. The government won't admit it, but China is putting pressure on us using trade. Since May, the country's imposed an 80% tariff on our barley, suspended beef sales from some big abattoirs, launched a dumping investigation into sales of Australian wine. Just this week, China suspended imports from our largest grain exporter, CBH, claiming there were too many weed seeds in the product. So what's at stake here? What could we lose? Stephanie Males is a partner at PwC.
If we look at beef exports to China, if we look at the 2018-19 numbers, we were sitting around 1.7 billion to China.
Yep.
That's of a total beef exports of 8.8 billion.
Right.
So you can see that there is a reasonable share of beef exports that do go to China of our total beef exports. If you look at comparatively from a barley perspective, our barley exports to China have reduced. So in 2018-19, our barley exports were just under a billion of a total of 1.9 billion in total exports of barley. And that compares, you know, prior year or you know, year on year of our exports to China in barley of $1.5 billion. So you can see that exports are down by half year on year.
So that's been coming down for well over a year. In fact, for probably more than 2 years. What about wine, Stephanie?
So from a wine perspective, we've seen that wine exports to China have doubled. So as at the 18-19 numbers, wine exports to China were just over $1 billion, and total wine exports now are over $2.2 billion. So this was double the value of Australia's wine exports to China on the prior year, and really reflecting the growth of our international reputation of our wines.
Right. So beef to China was in 18-19, I think you said $1.7 billion out of $8.85. So that's not a massive chunk, but it's significant. Barley was $0.9 billion out of total exports of $1.9 billion, and that had already come down. So that's been trending down. And wine has been going gangbusters. But I'm wondering, Stephanie, if the pandemic also makes things harder.
About 12 months ago, we did an assessment in the US-China trade war environment. And at that time, we came up with a number of perspectives, if you like, around what businesses need to focus on from a trade perspective. And one of those number one issues was supply chain challenges. Now, roll forward in between, we've had a pandemic, and it's now the time frame within which we're able to respond. And what I mean by that is, in a short term, what are the opportunities for us to move into different markets, to change the way that we source those products, and what that means to being able to supply those goods to customers and clients really quickly has been some of those real challenges in a short-term environment.
Have we been able to, I suppose, develop approaches to try to deal with that, specifically when it comes to getting our products overseas?
Yeah, we have. And one of the great initiatives that was released right at the beginning of COVID in March, April, was the government's approach to establishing the International Freight Assistance Mechanism. And what that's done is really enable, from an air freight perspective, the ability to get our products, particularly agricultural products that are perishable in nature, into international markets as quickly as possible to maintain that premium product that we're renowned for.
Right. So this is high-end products. One thinks of some of the super high-quality seafood that goes out of South Australia and into places like the Tokyo seafood market.
Spot on. That's exactly right. And it's the mechanism to provide the accessibility into those markets.
If we come back to sort of beef and barley and wine, I'm wondering about other markets, because I understand that we can sell barley into some Southeast Asian markets, but because the end use of the barley will be animal feed rather than making beer, we won't get the premium that we've been getting on the barley sales into China.
That's very true. And what we're seeing is that the recent shifts in the trading environment for agricultural products will see some farmers adapting and adjusting their stock in the medium term to alleviate pressure on margins in the changing trading environment. They'll diversify towards alternative, you know, lower value markets, as you've correctly alluded to. The pandemic has really reinforced the issues with having concentrated supply chains that are heavily dependent on single markets.
One man who's having to think about this is Barry West. He's a farmer in the Coolanshire, Western Australia. About half of his crop is barley. And just this week, China suspended imports of the grain handled by CBH, the very firm he sells his barley to.
It probably won't have a huge effect, because when they put the 80% tariff on our barley, that's when the price of barley basically dropped, you know, $50 a ton for us out here. We can't see the price moving much more, because that kind of meant we weren't going to sell barley to China anyway.
So let's go back to that. When did they do that? Because I think a lot of people listening now will be like, yeah, there's a tariff on Australian barley, but they won't quite remember the timeline.
Well, the timeline for that was around the end of May. And people like us, we grow about 2,000 hectares of barley. It's about 50% of our program, so it's quite substantial for our budget. They put the tariff on about 2 days after we finished seeding the barley into the ground. We actually had quite a bit of it up out of the ground and growing and looking fairly good, and it still looks pretty reasonable. So I don't know if they waited for us to finish seeding or it was just very coincidental. They seemed to let us go and spend our money on putting the barley crop in the ground and then dropping an 80% tariff on it, which basically said, we're not going to buy your barley, even though you've just put it in the ground. Thanks very much.
So for a grower like you, you usually sell a fair bit to CBH. Does this mean you're looking for other people to move the product, or do you think CBH can find other markets?
Well, CBH will still find other markets. CBH actually do a very good job in the marketing area. There's about 70 buyers of grain in the Kwinana zone, which is where we are.
Mm.
So there's a lot of people out there trying to buy grain off farmers, and they're buying for companies that need grain for flour mills or malting for whiskey or other stuff, beer, obviously, for a lot of the barley. And then there's the feed barleys that go into feedlots to produce protein through animal production. So, there's all that side of it.
That's one of the issues, isn't it? Because the barley that we were selling to China, I understand that was mostly going into beer making, but the barley that we might sell into Southeast Asia, that's going to go into feedlots, and we don't get the premium for that barley that we would get for beer.
Yeah, the malting barley, which is the best grades you can get. We all aim to get malting barley. Our production here, we seem to hit about that 50% of our barley will hit that malt market, which is, it's worth quite a bit more. It's $20 or $30 a tonne more. Yeah, look, to produce beer or whiskey or anything, it has to be the best quality, and it's quite a strict guidelines as to what that is. So the protein has to be right, the screenings have to be right. If you put the wrong barley in a malting process, you muck up the whole malt, which mucks up all the beer. So they just can't afford to do that. So if it's downgraded and it won't make that malt, it will go as a feed barley, which it then goes through feedlots and things like that, yeah.
So it's going to be hard to get the price you would have liked, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. The barley price currently today is $2.27 a tonne for feed barley.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we sort of base it on. The malt price is always above that. The same time last year, it was sitting at around $2.72. So, there's $50 odd there difference right now. That price will fluctuate. Companies like CBH now are currently trying to sell more barley into somewhere like India.
Mm-hmm.
India currently takes only about 500,000 tonne. We would like them to use more barley to drink beer and make beer, obviously. But as we know, India's taken a real hit with this coronavirus. And when it drives economies down, the first thing that people stop doing is luxury items such as having a quiet beer after work.
Yeah.
So we're sort of looking at Thailand, Middle East. Japan buys a nice amount of barley off us, mainly for soju production and beer production. But I doubt whether we'd increase those markets much. They're sort of at that level where they're getting what they want from us.
And the effects of coronavirus, and you add in the politics of our trade relationship with China, it adds more uncertainty, doesn't it, in terms of running the farm and decisions you're making about next year and beyond?
Yeah, our farm budget right now is not looking really good. We kind of budget on 10-year averages, and at the moment we're way below those numbers. It's having a huge effect on our economy as farmers.
All right, Barry. Well, look, I hope you get a bit of clarity and indeed some good news sooner rather than later.
Yes, it'd be nice to turn some of these prices around, but we can't really see an upside for barley. We've basically got to put this barley that we produce for China, and it's the same old story. We've put too many eggs in one basket, I suppose, so it always comes around to bite you when you drop the basket.
I read something really interesting the other day. This was some research from Rabobank, that though we are very exposed to the Chinese market, a lot of our export products, and especially agricultural products, that exposure may just have peaked, and perhaps the future does look more diverse in terms of our markets.
I would reflect and go back to the trend that we're seeing, and as you could imagine, it's very difficult to predict what the future will bring, particularly in a pandemic, and then as we come out of the pandemic, is, we're showing a year-on-year increase in exports to China. So if that's an indication, the most recent data that came out for June 2020 shows goods exports in the vicinity of, you know, 14,000 million. Imports from China for June were at 7,500 million, indicating that we are exporting twice as much to China as we import in goods. So that balance of import v export would suggest that our export markets are absolutely critical at the moment.
So it seems like that the really big commodities that we export to China, they're not agricultural, they're iron ore, first of all, and coal. They look pretty solid, don't they?
So the iron ore exports to China are strong, and that's due to the current shortage of high-quality iron ore globally. So this creates what we're seeing as being a short-term opportunity for us. But in the long term, we need to be open to markets elsewhere. And having as broad a base as possible in those export pathways provides the best conditions for a diversified supply chain.
Photonics, the industry that uses and manipulates light, turns out to be everywhere. If you're listening via a podcast, you're using it now. It's also quite the export success story. Simon Poole has co-authored a report that puts a value on it.
It's the very high capacity links that link together the data centres that we talk to, link countries, link cities together. That's all done through optical fibres, and optical fibres are everywhere. They're to every telephone exchange, to many streets through the NBN network, and linking, say, countries and continents through undersea cables.
In fact, our voices are going through this right now as we speak.
Exactly, exactly. Can you imagine what the lockdowns would have been like without the ability to stream high-definition videos, your Netflix, your Zooms, all of which is basically enabled by having these optical fibre networks underpinning the internet?
As you say all this, I'm thinking, when I get up, I'm looking at my phone, my phone's always talking to the internet. It's sort of happening all the time for nearly all of us, and most of us aren't aware of that at all.
That's absolutely right. You can basically, you almost can't get out of bed without the use of photonics. You know, even looking at your alarm clock, you've got displays in there which are generally sort of photonics based, switch on the light, pick up your phone to check your emails. You don't start the day without your photonics support that gets you there.
There's a slogan there, I feel, Simon. Now, you tried to put a value on the sector. What did you come up with?
Okay, yeah, so we did analysis of both Australia and New Zealand. I'll focus here on Australia. And we think that the sort of the manufacturing output within Australia is somewhere just north of $4 billion. That's about 1% of the total manufacturing industry in Australia. It's a non-trivial activity. It's a similar sort of size to the farm gate dairy industry, for example.
Right.
So, you know, most people are familiar with the sort of the fact that Australia has a great dairy industry. People are really much less familiar with the fact that we've also got a very healthy photonics industry.
Yeah. Just over $4 billion is not trivial. Is this growing?
Yes, it is growing. Photonics is definitely one of the growth areas globally. Typically, photonics has been growing at around about 5 to 6% per annum for the last couple of decades. So that's ahead of the average growth in manufacturing, which is more like 2 to 3%. And clearly, you know, as we get more and more dependent upon the high-speed backbone for the internet, which optical fibres and photonics plays a major part, that will continue to be an important part of our economy.
So I understand that a company that you've founded in the past, Finisar, you helped develop a switch that's in all fibre optic cables around the world. Can you tell me a bit about that?
One of the things that you'll have noticed is the cost of connecting to the internet, for example, hasn't really changed over the last decade or two. Despite the fact we're now downloading high-definition TV, whereas before it was just used for emails and simple web browsing. So we've had to focus as an industry on developing technologies which reduce the cost of sending data around. And my company, Finisar, developed basically what's the optical equivalent of electrical switch. So we can switch light around between different optical fibers in a network. So we can route signals around a network just using light rather than going into electronics. And you may say, okay, well, what's the advantage of that? Well, there are a whole range of advantages, primarily down to the speed of information, the capacity of how much data we can put through there, but also the environmental cost, it is much, much more efficient to switch light than it is to switch electronics by about five orders of magnitude. So 100,000 times less energy used to switch light than there is electronics for equivalent amount of data. So it's really a very green technology as well sitting underneath all of this.
Right. So without it, we wouldn't have the same internet speeds we have now. Or if we did, we'd have to pay a lot more for them, basically.
Absolutely, yes. And Finisar, which is a company that we built in Sydney and which still has its manufacturing here in Sydney, that company has about 40% of the world market for these optical switches that are used. So it's, and it's 100% export out of Australia. So it's been a real success story in terms of being a locally grown and locally built manufacturer.
So who are the customers for these extremely clever switches?
So the customers are the people who build the equipment for communications networks. So people like Huawei in China, Alcatel in Europe, Ciena, Lucent in the US. So it's those equipment manufacturers
right.
who then sell to the telecommunications and data communications companies around the place. So we know that our switches are in use throughout Australia. There are many hundreds, possibly thousands of them within the networks in Australia. But they're hidden inside other people's equipment, so nobody knows they're there. And so they'll be across NBN and Telstra and those sort of networks, but hidden away with somebody else's name on the front panel.
You've developed another business that's also using photonics. What is that?
Certainly. This is the company Cylite, which is basically a company that has developed and is now manufacturing a new type of system for measuring the properties of your eye. So this is for optometrists and ophthalmologists to really very, very precisely characterize all the properties of the eye in a non-contact way. So if you're having, for example, cataract surgery, you'll be able to predict much more precisely the sort of replacement lenses you need. Or if you have scleral or other high-end contact lenses, then those can be much more properly fitted to the eye.
Right.
And one really important in this is the we want to be and will be getting involved in the diagnosis and treatment of myopia, which is a massive problem and massively growing problem as we move from an outside-focused type of life into an indoors life where we spend most of our life, certainly I do these days, staring at computer screens.
This is the photonics industry's fault, of course, that this has happened. So
this is kind of karma to this. Yes, we'll come quietly.
Yeah. Now, where are you with all your product development, Simon? Are you actually selling things now, or are you still working on them, or what?
Product development is something that never stops. You're always trying to improve, but we are selling. We are currently waiting for final clinical approval to be able to launch our first product into Europe. We have sold a number of units around the world, including into Australia, the US and Europe, into the research community, where it's been very well received. And we're expecting to get our final clinical approval for Europe later this year, after which we will then be going straight into Australian clinical approval for release, hopefully at the start of next year.
Simon Poole from Cylite. And that's it for this week. Thanks to producer Belinda Summer and sound engineer Emrys Cronin. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.